This is an ABC podcast.
The workload that teachers have already is enormous, and to then get schools to monitor that parents are doing a RAT test on their students twice a week, it just isn't possible. You don't have the manpower, and teachers just don't have the time.
As schools across New South Wales scramble to distribute supplies of rapid antigen tests ahead of classes resuming, principals and teachers say it won't be their role to check if students are using the tests. That story soon. And the challenge of accessing emergency services in rural Australia.
I was in the house and got a phone call, and as soon as I left the house, my emergency services call dropped out. And the last thing I heard a lady say was, he might not respond, he's in a bad way.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. Schools across New South Wales are scrambling to distribute rapid antigen tests to students ahead of the start of Term 1 next week. Under the state's back-to-school plan, tests and ventilation equipment are being delivered to schools. Mask wearing will be mandatory for all teachers and high school students, with primary schoolers encouraged to wear them. But some have raised concerns about the effectiveness of the strategy, given the testing of students won't be monitored and enforced, while parents of children with disabilities are concerned about what the recommendations mean for them. Alexandra Jones reports.
Principals in New South Wales say they will not police the recommendation for students to do two rapid antigen tests per week under the state's back-to-school plan. The government has promised to distribute 6 million rapid antigen tests to 3,000 schools across the state, with students to collect the kits and conduct two tests at home per week for the first month of the school term. The principal of St Columba Anglican School in Port Macquarie, Terry Muldoon, said his school would not be monitoring the surveillance testing of students.
I don't think we're the police, so I don't think we can actually enforce. What we'll do is request that our families follow the advice from health and the government. I don't think we'll have any trouble with our families following the guidelines as long as we are supplied with what we need to actually follow the guidelines.
The president of the New South Wales Secondary Principals Council, Craig Peterson, said the New South Wales Education Secretary told a meeting of school principals on Monday the testing would not be mandatory.
It would be almost impossible to police a mandated testing program. We really don't have the capacity to do that. We're really encouraging families to support the school by voluntarily conducting those tests and keeping us informed. And then what we will do in return is obviously we'll communicate with our school communities. If we do get any positive cases, we'll let the parents know, whether it was a staff member, whether it was a particular year group that's impacted, and then we'll be asking them to monitor the signs and symptoms and obviously continue testing their own children. At the end of the day, it's something that we can't control. We'll be distributing the tests and then relying on parents and carers to administer those tests and report. At that point, there's really nothing else that the school can do.
Primary school teacher Amy Harland agrees it's impractical to expect schools to ensure the testing of students, saying teachers already have enough on their plate heading into the new school year.
The workload that teachers have already is enormous, and to then get schools to monitor that parents are doing a RAT test on their students twice a week, it just isn't possible. You don't have the manpower, and teachers just don't have the time. I think that the COVID situation that we're moving forward with in Term 1 is going to exacerbate the teacher shortages that we have across New South Wales. The testing twice a week, the fact that parents can choose whether they test twice a week, means it's basically a trust system. So if the majority of parents aren't going to test twice a week, is that really going to be a risk mitigation strategy?
There have also been concerns raised by parents of children with disabilities who say they've been ignored and excluded from recommendations in the back-to-school plan. Joanne Murter from Tuncurry on the mid-north coast said her son Luke, who has level 3 autism, sensory processing disorder, ADHD and ADD, will simply not be able to take rapid antigen tests.
There is no way we'll get anything up his nose or in his mouth. The doctors can't even do blood pressure checks on him, so no one will have any chance of doing a swab on him because they can't even look in his mouth to look at his tonsils. He won't wear the blue mask that we wear, the disposable, because of the texture. So that's a sensory issue. He will have a meltdown over it, and it's not worth going through a meltdown to put it on. It's brought a lot of tears for some of us. There's a lot of anger and frustration. We all feel exactly the same and we're all wondering how we're all going to get through it. Special needs have had no consideration. We're excluded. They think that we're all just mainstream and that we just fit into this black and white model.
On Monday, Education Secretary Georgina Harrison and Health Minister Brad Hazzard were asked about young children and those with special needs being tested every 2 days. They said if parents calmly explain why they're doing the tests, that they would quickly learn to accommodate. The CEO of Autism Awareness Australia, Nicole Rogerson, said the response was completely inappropriate.
I think it's frightening that in New South Wales, both the Health Minister and the Education Minister don't understand disability and autism enough that they would make that response. Too often during COVID, we've seen that people with disability are just an afterthought when the government makes these policies. They need to understand that giving a rapid antigen test to children who have autism and developmental delays is difficult enough to do on the odd chance you need to do it because you can see they've got a symptom. But the idea of doing it twice a week to children who may not understand it, who could be quite traumatised by it, I mean, it's just simply not going to happen.
That's the CEO of Autism Awareness Australia ending that story from Alexandra Jones.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. A New South Wales Victoria border resident is pleading for urgent changes to ambulance triaging during the pandemic after her husband stopped breathing at their home at How Long, west of Albury. Shannon Corvo spoke with Lynette Cullinan, who says they waited 2 hours for an ambulance.
Just after finishing their lunch together on January 4, Lynette transported her husband, Peter, in a wheelchair into the bathroom. What happened next was a life-threatening emergency. The Vietnam veteran's skin graft ruptured.
The blood was literally pouring out, even though he already had dressings, gauze and a compressed bandage on him.
She activated the Emergency Assistance Medical Safety Link alarm at their home at How Long, about 30 kilometres west of Albury in New South Wales.
Now, they've told me it can take them up to 18 minutes to get through to 000.
She says 000 contacted her via Safety Link about half an hour later.
I told them, this man is bleeding out, I'm going to lose him, I need an ambulance. Now, she goes, I'm sorry, I cannot give you a timeline. It could be an hour, it could be 2 hours. And I said, I need an ambulance now. And her response was, I'm only 000.
With no idea when the ambulance would arrive, and with her hands busy trying to stem the bleeding, she posted an urgent call out on Facebook. And luckily, help arrived.
My daughter in Canberra saw the post. She rang Albury RFS, Corowa Fire Brigade, SES paramedics, How Long RFS. Units from everywhere came together and arrived within, I guess, 45 minutes to an hour after my daughter put the call in. They all arrived before the ambos. I'm lucky he's alive and I have our rural emergency services to thank for that.
Lynette's daughter, Kat, who doesn't want her surname used, says when she got the social media notification about her mum's post, she was terrified.
It's scary to not only find out that your dad's bleeding out from Facebook, but to also know that your mother's had to go to that extent because she can't get the help she needs.
Lynette says the ambulance arrived around 2 p.m. and the first thing they did was call for backup.
My husband was eventually, after nearly losing close to 3 litres of blood in our bathroom and bedroom, was eventually transported to Wodonga.
Peter was then transferred to Albury and then on to Melbourne.
At which point he has now had 4 blood transfusions, 1 iron transfusion and surgery on this wound to burn and cauterise vessels and veins.
Peter survived the ordeal and is still in hospital recovering, but the experience has left Lynette traumatised. She's pleading for urgent changes to the ambulance system during the pandemic.
My problem is I nearly lost my husband because we don't in our region have the emergency services regarding ambulances at this point in time we need.
A New South Wales ambulance spokesperson says it works closely with Ambulance Victoria and the closest resource is deployed to any patient, regardless of which side of the border an ambulance is located. They say in this case, New South Wales received a 000 call and Ambulance Victoria responded. They also say due to an increase in demand due to the surge in Omicron cases, New South Wales Ambulance's staff have been surged and an extra 50 call takers have been recruited at the control centres. The ABC understands Ambulance Victoria was dispatched within 2 minutes of the call being received by the Emergency Services Telecommunications Authority. Ambulance Victoria declined to be interviewed.
Shannon Corvo with that story. And staying with access to emergency services, a Riverina farmer who lost his leg in a harvest accident in December is calling for improved phone reception after he and his wife struggled to communicate with emergency services despite living just 30 kilometres from Wagga. Aaron McCarthy from The Rock surprised first responders by keeping such a level head that he was able to shake their hands and introduce himself when they arrived on the scene. Aaron is now back home with his family and says he hopes to be back farming as normal within 12 months. The father of two and his wife Tani sat down with our rural reporter Olivia Calver.
I guess I'd done what I had to do. So I got out of the machine and crawled away from it and had my phone in my pocket. I thankfully didn't leave it in the tractor at the time. So got my phone out and saw that it had at the top emergency calls only. So rung 000 and we've got terrible service out here. So I yelled at him about four times, who I was, where I was and what had happened. And then I remember the operator asking if I could tourniquet it and I said I didn't really have anything. She suggested my shirt, so I took it off and wrapped it around my leg. Yeah, picked up the phone again, and because the service is so poor out here, the phone had dropped out. They said that there was a few ambulance and coppers on the way, so they hung up from me and rung my wife, who was at the house. She came out and found me. The police turned up first, the highway patrol, and they came running down. And I think one of the first things I said to them was, hey, how you going? I'm Aaron, nice to meet you. And put my hand out and shook his hand.
Just so lucky that you had your phone on you at the time, even though obviously reception is an issue.
We're definitely going to advocate for better service. I was in the house and got a phone call, and as soon as I left the house, my emergency services call dropped out. And the last thing I heard a lady say was, he might not respond, he's in a bad way. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what am I going to find? And I'm throwing a naked baby into the car and driving around a property trying to find where Aaron would be with no service and no advice on the other end of the line because we have no service and we're only 30 km from Wagga.
Not like you're far out back, you're no. So close.
Yeah, like Tony said, we're only, 30 km from a regional city. They're rolling. Trying to roll out 5G and whatever, and we can't even hold a 4G call near a regional centre. It's ridiculous.
What's the experience been like in the last few weeks? Obviously, you're home now and you're adjusting to life that is very different. But how are you feeling about everything going forward and the farm and being here with your family?
Adjusting to home life's been... It's been a challenge, not being able to do the things I used to do, but we're slowly learning how to get through it all at home. So it's going fairly well. Dad's sort of nearly semi-retired, so he's given me a hand quite a bit. Yeah, ongoing. Hopefully we can get a prosthetic sorted soon in a few months. Hopefully it'll all get back to normal in another 12 months or so, and I'll be able to do most things.
How have you felt about the support that you and your family have been given from the wider community? There's obviously the GoFundMe that was set up, raised close to $50,000 at last count.
The support has been amazing. Like, we didn't expect anything from anyone really, but it's blown our minds how much support we have received.
Heard that some people jumped in to help harvest the rest of the crop, is that right?
The neighbour came over when he had a bit of spare time. He came over and finished it for me, which was absolutely amazing. I'd borrowed my boss's truck to cart my weed in. Yeah, the truck was full when the accident happened, so he came out and grabbed the truck because he needed it, and took my NGR card into the local grain storage, and he managed to take a couple of loads of I think his canola in and pass that out to a few farmers to get a bit of grain donated my way as well, which is absolutely unreal.
We do wish them all the very best. That's Aaron and Tani McCarthy in the Riverina there speaking to Olivia Calver. In a statement, Telstra Regional General Manager Chris Taylor said 4G coverage is available at The Rock and surrounding regions, or the surrounding region, but a number of environmental factors can affect mobile coverage, such as terrain and the distance from the tower. Any calls to 000 are automatically connected to any other working mobile base station in the area, regardless of the carrier. Meanwhile, the community has also started a petition calling on Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce to improve phone reception at The Rock following the accident.
ABC Australia Wide.
The tourism sector was once one of the biggest employers in tropical North Queensland, home of the Great Barrier Reef and World Heritage listed rainforest. But nearly 2 years after the COVID-19 pandemic began, a combination of international border closures and continuing uncertainty surrounding domestic travel, the payroll has dried up. It's estimated more than 9,000 tourism jobs have been lost so far in North Queensland, as Cairns-based reporter Christy Sexton-McGrath reports.
Cairns restaurateur Craig Squire has been serving up modern Australian cuisine since 1994. Normally his waterfront restaurant would operate 7 days a week, but he says he's been forced to cut back due to a lack of staff, many of whom are waiting on COVID-19 test results. He says the normally busy Christmas holiday period has been anything but, despite Queensland's border reopening in December.
Over the last few weeks since Christmas, really, we had a couple of good potential weeks in Cairns with numbers-wise, locals going out and tourism. But the first week of January, we had five staff out waiting on test results. So that really put a dampener on what would have been quite a successful trading week. And we actually had to close for several days. And the reason they were waiting so long is because of the very slow turnaround on PCRs and the complete lack of RAT tests available. And then the following week, second week, we actually had four staff down with COVID itself. And then we also had to cap the numbers. So when it was really busy with tourism that first part of January, we were basically operating at 50% of capacity. Because, you know, we don't want to open and do a bad job.
Cairns restaurants have traditionally relied on backpackers and holiday makers on working visas to wait tables and serve drinks behind bars. Mr Squire says that it's this loss of workers, combined with COVID-19 vaccination mandates, which require that all people that eat in his waterfront restaurant are vaccinated, that's killing businesses like his.
Queensland, as I've said a week back, welcomed all Australians into Queensland, the unvaxxed, without any border controls whatsoever. I just question why I have to control that vaccination mandate in my business when the whole state doesn't have to do it. We need to keep pressure on the government about the mandates for hospitality. I mean, the concept that the unvaccinated can't go to restaurants and cafes but can go to gyms and hairdressers and food courts, mind you, even licensed food courts, you know, it just doesn't stick. There's no science behind it. It's basically started as a coercive measure to get more people vaccinated. We're at 90% now. Surely we can let go of these controls.
The region's peak tourism body estimates 9,000 jobs, more than half of the local industry's tourism workforce, have been lost in far north Queensland since the pandemic began. Tourism Tropical North Queensland CEO Mark Olson says it's a huge chunk of the 15,000 strong full and part-time staff the sector employed before the pandemic began.
What's been really difficult for this part of the world without international visitation is we've lost about 9,000 staff over the last 22 months. At first, it was the frontline staff, those on the part-time and casual roles. But as the pandemic extended on, we started losing highly skilled staff. And even in the last few weeks, we've seen businesses have to stand down some of their most senior staff because the cash flow is so tight. So we've lost a lot of skill and experience that has guided the region over a decade or more in understanding the international markets, having that cultural sensitivity, providing that world-class service.
He says he's confident that when international borders do open to all visitors, they will come. But government support could be needed to help bring back the thousands of former tourism workers who have since left the region or gone into other industries.
We've got what the world is looking for here in Queensland, particularly here in Cairns and the Great Barrier Reef. We know that the customers love what we have. They love the clean open spaces. They love these big natural environments. Of course, they love the Great Barrier Reef and the World Heritage Rainforest. They're really starting to connect with the oldest living culture on Earth, our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we know we've got the right ingredients, and we will need to make sure that those businesses who have been through such a tough time, particularly in their cash flow, have got the support to get back out there. Many businesses are going to need that extra support. Before COVID hit, the Cairns and Great Barrier Reef tourism industry contributed over $1 billion a year of tax revenue into the Australian and Queensland governments. That supports a lot of schools, a lot of hospitals, a lot of roads, a lot of public infrastructure. So we're looking forward to getting that momentum back again, bringing those jobs back into the region and bringing that export dollar internationally and interstate back into Cairns and the Great Barrier Reef.
That story from Christy Sexton-McGrath in Cairns there. And finally, an Australian manufacturer of AdBlue has reached a new milestone last week, producing more than 3 million litres of the anti-pollutant fuel additive. You'll remember late last year, there were concerns Australia would run out of the diesel exhaust fluid due to a global shortage of urea, which is a key ingredient in AdBlue. That prompted the federal government to give international chemical company Incitec Pivot a $30 million grant to increase domestic production at its Queensland plant. CEO of Heavy Vehicles Industry Australia, Todd Hacking, says the deal should keep trucks on the road.
We've probably got about 2 months left of that deal. It was a milestone week last week in that IPL for the first time hit their 3 million litres a week, which is about sort of four or five times their usual business as usual sort of supply into the market. And it's a really significant supply deal, which will hopefully keep the trucks running and make sure that we can continue to keep food on the table and on the grocery shelves.
You've mentioned that you've got about 2 months left on this deal that was put forward. Has it got the potential of becoming a more ongoing, consistent supply?
Yes, it does. So that would just be a decision between IPL and the government, or whether IPL saw that there was an ongoing opportunity to fund this work themselves, or whether there was another commercial agreement. But certainly there's a demand for AdBlue or technical grade urea. And I think that's been demonstrated. And I think a lot of Australians are asking the onshoring question, which is, you know, why are we so reliant on international supply or something that literally without, you know, puts us in a very precarious position. So there's a lot of comfort in having this locally manufactured. And that's something that certainly the industry would be open to having go for a lot longer than just this immediate short-term period.
Todd, are we paying more or less for this technical-grade urea than I guess we would be if we were getting it off China still?
We're currently paying more, but that is A, because there is a shortage, and that's just supply-demand factors at play. You know, moving forward, once that supply and demand evens out and there's a lot more confidence going forward, I think you'll see some stability in the price. But I certainly think that the days of old where we were paying a lot less for this additive is kind of over. We've got to get used to a new normal. But certainly, no one wants to pay any more than they have to or what they should be paying. And there's regulators in force to make sure that, yeah, there's no price gouging and other unfair commercial decisions at play. So certainly, the cheaper we can get it, the better off the industry is. But that's obviously, you know, a commercial decision which people will make up their own mind as they go forward.
3 million litres a week, what percentage of Australia's demand is that?
That would be getting very, very close to sort of somewhere between 80 and 100%. You know, certainly it would be a significant factor in the business as usual demand for AdBlue. So it is a significant deal. And the importance of the deal was that it has allowed the AdBlue manufacturers to just replenish their stocks from their traditional sources, and it's bought them time to try and find additional supply through other countries in the world. And we're not out of the woods yet. It's still a week-by-week proposition, and we're still watching it very, very closely. And the overarching message is just buy enough that you need. But we are certainly in a much, much more stable position than we were sort of in November and December.
That's Heavy Vehicles Industry Australia CEO Todd Hacking speaking with Hugo Ricard-Bell there. And that is Australia-wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. Have a great evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.